Hello. I hope that a class in which we do not meet, but in which we talk to one another, is a moment of concentration and focus in what is now a world of distraction and confusion. The paradoxical relationship between the virus and reality that millions of people can be ill and million people can have died, and the sickness of one sick old man is nonetheless of greater weight in all our minds than all the rest of that suffering and dying, is a terrible warning about the extent to which our own nervous systems, and even more importantly, the fragile work that emerges from them we call our minds, is subject to reorganization through the external impressions of the nervous system we have built around us. 20th century mass communications, broadcasting as we called it, had of course a significant and meaningful effect. The 6 o'clock news and the late night comic had an opportunity to orient the nation and ultimately the race around conversations, what we called the water cooler at the office after the occasions on which we were all temporarily and rather fragilely linked together by the evening's event on television. But that is nothing to the process by which exterior nervous impulses are communicated to us by buzzing, clicking, beeping, vibrating, and all the rest of it all the time, connected to our nervous system through a ganglion that is owned and operated by us for the benefit of some people and things elsewhere. The underlying proposition, then, of what we do together is that we can think about this nervous system independently, which it is still possible for us to do. It is still possible to observe the bad film that is The Social Dilemma being rebutted by bad verbal nonsense from Facebook, which perhaps you did. But more importantly, that we can think about what life was like before these things, which will be difficult to do for those born after these things have become nature in a little while. In the face of that extraordinary disruption, which you can feel all over you these days, the crucial animating alternative is your own ideas. And I hope by the end of this week you will have come to sundown Friday having had an idea and taken a stab at expressing it. I hope that as I am spending the days afterwards editing these ideas as they have been expressed, and hoping at any rate on my part to make them better, that you will also be reading one another and meeting the ideas of a group of people joined in a moment of chaos by what might also be 30 moments of clarity. I noticed that I treasured these few moments face to face in the park we are beginning to have, if you are a masked face in the park, because it's hard to teach in the first and second era senses without being in the same place, without breathing the same air, more or less. Which makes it all the more fraught at a time like this. I think the external instruction schedule is probably stable now. We'll need this week to see, and then we can add some telephonic small groups to our mix for those who don't live in New York and don't have to sit outside in the cold air shifting as the autumn takes hold in Riverside Park, if there is any more autumn in New York City. So we should have plenty to do, but I do need to say plenty today because there are a couple of subjects that lie underneath all of our concerns, which you don't get to meet in the movies, and which we now begin to think systematically about. To locate ourselves in the larger picture, I have said that we are building the extraskeletal nervous system of a superorganism humanity is turning into, and that that net that we have made in order to make it possible to exchange our ideas for every brain on earth to learn whatever it wants, to eliminate ignorance, and to initiate the flowering of freedom of thought has cancerously turned itself. That we have incubated within it an organism, the parasite with the mind of God, which collects and remembers vast quantities of human behavior measured down to the smallest possible granules of inference by a neuron closest to each of us, this spy satellite in our pockets, this thing meant to measure us millisecond by millisecond, sense by sense, intention by intention, that this entity which metabolizes human behavior and which emits stimuli into the nervous system for the creation of more behavior, seeking to keep each human being at the end of each filament of the net engaged with the parasite, exchanging behavior and stimulus for behavior infinitely, filling the memory of the parasite with everything that you think and do and with the largest emergent patterns of human behavior of which you cannot be aware because only an eye that sees everything from the fall of every sparrow to the destiny of the universe, only the thing we used to call the mind of God and have built within the parasite can know what the parasite can know. I have said that all of this is now living within a form which can be described in political economy as Shoshana Zuboff describes it as surveillance capitalism, but which is fundamentally larger than its political economy, as it is larger than the anatomy we built in the net and the physiology we produce for it in software. But now we need to follow a line through that physiology which we began to describe last week, the nature of software in the net, and we need to begin to understand precisely how certain forms of legal interaction around software fundamentally affect the nature of the network's physiology in favorem libertatis, in the direction of freedom, or the opposite. That's the subject of our moment together, apart today. So let us consider just for a moment the larger political economy within which surveillance capitalism itself developed. The net could be operated in many different ways. Its software could impose upon it many different kinds of rules. The rules of surveillance capitalism are not the rules of the physiology of the net. They are a set of the rules of the physiology of the net, and they are made of software, as all such physiological principles are. And software in itself is merely an example of the larger kind of material we make and distribute in the economy of now, consisting of bit streams, of digital objects, of entities consisting of binary strings of ones and zeros, which can be understood by digital computers in their relation to human beings in many different ways. A bitstream can be a computer program meant to be executed, a living piece of the fundamental physiological material of the net, proteins in action. A bitstream can also be, however, a map, a novel, choreography, music, both noted and performed, the structure of telemetry emerging from a road with vehicles on it, a 100 million sensor hospital engaged in containing and treating the bodies of 1,000 human beings who are ill. A bitstream can be any number of numbers of numbers of infinities of things. But what they are, whatever the bitstream will ultimately turn out to be when a computer is running, thinking, expressing, mutating that bitstream, whether software, music, movies, or the plans for something that will exist in the real world that will be built or manufactured or 3D printed, whatever a bitstream is, from the point of view of the economy in which it is produced and distributed, it is a kind of good. And the kind of good it is an unusual kind of good in the larger economic history of the human race. It is a good with zero marginal cost. That is to say, when one has incurred the cost of making the first copy of that bitstream, whether that means designing, implementing, and debugging a computer program, or whether that means performing Brahms second, or whether that means the process of making the collaborative work of public art that is Bisbee 17 or Mars Attacks, whatever that bitstream cost us in fixed costs, the time and trouble of skilled software manipulators we call programmers or developers, or whether it is the mix of skills and performances in space and time that is a motion picture, or whether it is a symphonic orchestra or just me talking to you now. Once one has incurred the costs of the first copy, all the remaining copies that the human race will ever need can be remanufactured, copied, and fixed in any convenient form, sent anywhere without friction or measurable cost. Goods, as we have traditionally accounted for them in our thinking about the human economy, goods have non-zero marginal cost. Each table, shoe, pork chop, or houseplant that we cultivate, each spy satellite, each smartphone, each automobile, each building I-beam costs something to make, to move, and to sell. The theory of the firm, the evolution of an idea about the basic workings of the microeconomy in which goods are made, moved, and sold, our understanding of the way that markets for goods work, which has developed over the last 200 years in all sorts of useful and valuable scientific inquiry, our understanding of the way this all happens with respect to the shoes, the tables, the chairs, the automobiles, the radio tubes, and everything else, the understanding is coherent and it is rich, and it allows us both to illuminate and to predict, as we hope that our systematic thinking will. Among the other results, no doubt, that you were shown in the first of the Economics 101 experiences that you had, where downward sloping demand curves and upward sloping supply curves met at points of equilibrium, one of the fundamental insights derived from just those first beginning graphs is that in a competitive economy, in a state of perfect competition, far easier to accommodate than the absence of air resistance in our basic physics, where we all have to throw our balls and bounce them perfectly elastically in vacuum, the condition of perfect competition, which is, as the right-wing parties of the West have loved to point out in the two generations between us and the Second World War, the perfectly competitive economy really means the world without government intervention and without rampant violence. But at any rate, in such an economy, we are assured by the reliable and well-evolved theory of the firm, the price of goods in such a condition of perfect competition asymptotically reaches equilibrium at marginal cost. That is ultimately what we pay for books and toasters and automobiles and t-shirts, is the marginal cost of producing the next one. But in the world of the digital revolution, of the evolution of our extraskeletal nervous system, in that world in which bit streams are a larger and larger proportion of the economy, we face, for the first time in the history of human beings, economies in which markets at zero marginal cost are large and powerful and important, just as markets with goods of non-zero marginal cost, steaks and salads and everything in between, just as important as the stuff of life that we have always known. Now, we shall see in a moment that it is not sufficient to divide the world only into goods with non-zero marginal cost and goods with zero marginal cost. We need to get more finely grained about the bit streams as we do about the shoes and the pork chops. But before we come there, let us just observe that the great challenge that has been posed to economics, or rather to political economy, in the rise of digitization is not that the theory of the firm is broken or that our understanding of economics in its micro 101 form has changed. On the contrary, the primary challenge posed to political economy in the last years of the 20th century and throughout the 21st is that microeconomic theory works perfectly well. Which means, of course, that the price at which all the marginal cost materials in the world should ultimately be transacted in a condition of competition is zero. Yes, to be sure, some bit streams have high fixed costs, just as some goods in the physical world have high fixed costs. And therefore, it may take a large number of units demanded before the fixed costs of the production of a bit stream have amortized themselves away in a competitive market. But in the end, the theory of the firm is correct, whether the amount demanded ultimately has to be very large or rather small is determined by the amount of fixed cost that requires to be amortized. But ultimately, the price asymptotically declines to zero if there is zero marginal cost. Yet, there is a great resistance amounting to a kind of ultimate metaphysical disbelief. So many students asked me, how could free software exist? As though the possibility that software would ultimately actually be transacted for at the marginal cost of delivering a copy was unforeseeable. And the principle that the poor should be deprived of music or software or maps unless they can afford to pay for them seems like natural justice. Hence a question posed in the .Communist Manifesto in one of that short string of words written not by Engels or by Marx, but by me, if it were possible to make as many loaves of bread as we required by baking one and pressing a button, what would be the moral case for anyone to go hungry? Sharply comes up against the expectation that somehow the rules of microeconomic understanding should be varied, that our economic physics should cease to work once we discovered that it is possible to eliminate ignorance and cultural deprivation. So the initial challenge posed by the reality that we can eliminate deprivation of all things that can be represented in bitstreams, that we can eliminate ignorance and cultural deprivation, that they don't have to exist anymore, is to amplify into sacredness existing interferences with perfect competition. Hence, after the Second World War in the United States, we gathered to ourselves a much more impressive theory of intellectual property and spread it out across the world as part of the global liberal understanding. Intellectual property is statutory monopolies interfering with perfect competition. It is said, either in some broadly common sense way or with specific relationship to particular 18th century forms of constitutional and legal material, that these monopoly rights are necessary in order to secure production in the first place. And this is an important subject to consider. But let us at the moment notice that the consequence of the developing importance of zero marginal cost goods in the broad spectrum of human activity is to put pressure on the question, why is the price not equal to the marginal cost, which is zero? Why do we wish to maintain artificial scarcity? This is why, by the end of the 20th century, even if most people hadn't seen it coming yet, and the economists were still largely laboring in darkness, I thought it was important to give voice to a principle of political economy that was evolved in 19th century European thinking, namely anarchism. Taken strictly, anarchism is a series of philosophic arguments and cultural propositions deprecating the idea of ownership. The essence of the anarchist proposition is that ownership imposes inequality and creates suffering. That in the 19th century phrase, property is theft. But to take it as a principle of actual social organization, anarchism is an invitation to consider social arrangements in which the productive and consumptive and spiritual lives of human beings can be led without recourse to principles of ownership. What happened at the end of the 20th century, as zero marginal cost goods became important in the economy, happened particularly to the form of goods that is executable software. And it is the relationship between anarchist production, that is production without ownership, without exclusion from production, and the systems of the physiology of the net, which led me in the beginning, in Anarchism Triumphant in 1999, at the end of the 20th century, to propose something about the natural future of software and therefore the possibilities of political liberation in the net. But in order to understand free software from the point of view from which we are currently proceeding, what we need to do is to come to a little bit more refined understanding about the dissipation of the need for ownership in relation to zero marginal cost digital goods. So, bitstreams, forms of activity and cultural outputs which are represented or are actually only present in things with zero marginal cost, can be economically divided for the purposes of further illumination of the political economy into a subclass, functional zero marginal cost goods and non-functional zero marginal cost goods. Let us see precisely what those meanings are. Functional goods with zero marginal costs are executable software, the spreadsheet program in your laptop, or the streaming software in your smartphone, or a map drawn digitally by OpenStreetMaps as well as by Google Maps in order to display for you a real-time mapping of the location where you are or of where someone else is. A functional bitstream is a bitstream which behaves actively in its relationship to people in some structure in which we can say that one bitstream is better or worse at its function than another. For example, out of the news of the day, Public Health England appears to have lost at least 16,000 NHS-conducted coronavirus cases because it kept all the information about tests and people found to be infected with the virus in a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet that had a million row maximum built into the software. Who would ever need a spreadsheet larger than a million rows? And because instead of using some other database software, they kept all their tables in one table in a database, they could not deal with more than a million tests, and they lost 16,000 of them. For this purpose, we can say that Excel is less functional software than any spreadsheet program that doesn't have a million row limit, or than, let us say, SQLite, which, well, anyway, you understand. So software, maps, and other forms of functional zero marginal cost goods can be said to be more or less good, and they can be improved by making them better. This is not the case with non-functional zero marginal cost goods. It is not evident that one can accurately state that the first recording Glenn Gould made of the Goldberg variations is better than the second. One can say for sure that it is faster, but one cannot say for sure that it is better, because such matters are not subject to functional comparison. Music, visual art, the making of movies with Arnold Schwarzenegger blowing things up, and other forms of non-functional, decorative, artistic, culturally valuable zero marginal cost goods, therefore, can be put in a second category of non-functionality. We could, at this point, if we met in a room or in a Zoom channel with an electric whiteboard in it, we could conceivably now engage in creation of one of those wonderful law professor four-box diagrams, but I will allow you to construct it in the capacious space of your imagination. That is to say, we have goods of zero and goods of non-zero marginal cost on one axis, and we have functional and non-functional goods on the other axis. But really, Forbrock's diagrams are a pain in the neck. We're really just asking, how do functional and non-functional digital goods behave differently with respect to the problem of ownership, as to which we can give a simple answer, which may require a little complicated explaining. In the world of functional, zero marginal cost goods, anarchist production, that is, production without ownership, leads eventually at equilibrium to superior goods. Anarchist production is superior production. In the world of non-functional, zero marginal cost goods, anarchist distribution, that is, distribution in which there is no property right in the right to distribute, anarchist distribution leads to superior distribution. So let us now go back and see why each of those statements is true. Here, let us take as the basic example of functional, zero marginal cost goods, executable computer software. As we discuss in the first couple of weeks of any law school property course, what is property? We come to hinge our understanding of property as a legal regime on the power to exclude. By making a particular relationship with a tree or a plot of ground or a violin property, we convey to the legally entitled owner of the property the right to exclude others, whether from physical propinquity to the property, from exploitation or economic use of the property, from inheritance of the property when an owner dies, or whatever else it may be. The central issue of the right of property is the right to exclude. And so also with respect to the principles that we called intellectual property after the Second World War, that is to say, the forms of state-granted monopoly which produce an enclosure on behalf of someone thereafter thought of as the owner, in copyright or patent or trade dress or trade secret or in some other particular form. When we talk then about anarchist production, we're talking about the production of a zero marginal cost form of functional good in which there is no exclusion from the right to produce. The traditional form in which the software came mostly to be regulated by law after 1979 in the United States was through copyright, a system of state-granted monopoly which gives to the owner of the copyright the right to exclude others from copying or modifying or redistributing the copyrighted work. Free software is then a principle not of making software to be distributed at zero cost so much as it is a system of making software in which nobody is excluded from production. What does it mean to say that nobody is excluded from production? It actually means either that somewhere there is the source code to this program, and if you wanted to make it better or different, you could find that source code, and you would be allowed to modify it and compile it or do whatever it takes to render it functional, and then distribute that code. This would be a weak form of non-exclusion. Or we could take a stronger form of non-exclusion and say that to make a program without ownership is actually to require that the people who receive the program be enabled, not merely allowed, but enabled to perform all of the work of making and improving and modifying and distributing that was done upstream from them, if you like, before they got the software themselves. These two different views about what it is that the non-exclusion from making, from producing, are, that is to say, a distinction between allowing subsequent production and enabling subsequent production, is an important distinction. We shall see soon that it affects the forms in which licensing rules were used to bring about non-exclusion from production, but we don't need to get as refined yet as the difference between permissive and copyleft licensing. We can leave that just for a moment and observe that what is happening is that the originators of a stream of bit streams, the computer program and all of its offspring, improvements, modifications, reintegrations, adaptations, the relationship between the original movers of the program and all of the subsequent people who change and improve and document and readapt and reuse, that the relationship between them is a relationship of cooperation rather than exclusion. And we can say that therefore over time code will be put to use in better and better ways. If your program as distributed contains a bug, I'll fix it. If your program as distributed does not provide a feature that I need, I'll make it. If the program as distributed contains a limitation, as say to a million rows for a database, and that limitation bothers or impedes me in my use of the software, I will reprogram to lift the limitation. In whatever way it is, therefore, that there is a difference between the function of the bitstream as it is and the function of the bitstream as each individual user wants it to be, there will be change and improvement. This is Lamarckian evolution, an inheritance of acquired characteristics accumulating over time. It produces rapid evolution of superior software, where superiority is measured by the total number of people who find it better than it was. What happens then when people are not excluded from the making or remaking of functional bitstreams? What happens is that the bit streams become over time more functional, and they are reused in ways which add to their function, and they merge and incorporate and find themselves better ways to meet the needs of the people for whom the software is written. This is why we can say that in a world of functional, zero marginal cost goods, anarchist production will yield superior results to production in proprietary style. This is what I was explaining in 1999 to account for the beginnings of the success of free software, which had then been in being for about 15 years, but which was just a beginning that inflection which brought it to a predictable dominance in global software. That is, after all, what I was predicting. The political economy of functional bitstreams included then not only the evolution of software, executable software, but the evolution of data storage designs and the evolution of maps and all sorts of other digital goods which also began to follow these principles. But law took the transformation of the principles of anarchist production in software further, faster than in other places, partly because there were people to invent those legal arrangements, of whom I was one, and partly because the superiority of production ultimately attracted the knowledgeable attention of the most sophisticated producers. So by the beginning of the 21st century, the companies in the world that were the most sophisticated producers of software, but who sold more than software, computer manufacturers like IBM and then Hewlett-Packard, came to be extremely involved in this evolving area of free software because they understood that anarchist production would produce better software, which would make it possible for them to sell better products. Only the world's dominant software maker, Microsoft, which was only a software maker, which made no other products, felt it necessary fundamentally to resist the idea that free software was the future of software making. But as I showed, by 1999, even Microsoft was beginning to experience an internal cultural conflict about that, one which terminated itself at the time of a generational change in corporate leadership into a Microsoft which ultimately fully believes in and manufactures and profits by services directed and around, made possible by anarchistically produced software. Next week, we shall take a closer look at the precise details of the law of software licensing, of copyright licensing that grew out of software licensing. But for the moment, our attention is primarily upon the matter of the political economy. Now, the same principle, when applied to non-functional bitstreams, yields a slightly different answer. Here, as I suggested in 1999, the easiest case to grasp from the position of the Edisonian 20th century was that of music. Folk music, so-called, demonstrates the enormous significance of music that isn't owned by anybody. So does, for that matter, all of Bach. Johann Sebastian Bach believed that all music was made ultimately by God. And he would have been very surprised to discover that in the late 20th century, in Germany and America and all the other places, people thought that music could be owned by somebody. Music, throughout the long history of the human race, is not a product of a kind that can readily lend itself to ownership. Even when it can be written down and discussed and thought about among literate people, it is still ultimately a matter of social communion. It is played somewhere. It isn't just that there can't be, as Sholem Aleichem says, a wedding without musicians. There cannot be music without musicians and people to listen. So in the beginning, we can treat music as a form of social communion. But the wonderful inventions of Thomas Alva Edison, actually a collective of human beings known as Thomas A. Edison, the inventions of the Edisonian tribe made it possible to treat music for the first time as a thing that could be made, durably transported, and consumed somewhere else, beyond the capacity of making. Music, then, in the Edisonian era, like the moving picture and other forms of cultural activity, came to be understood in a form which related itself not so much to how it was made as to how it was distributed. The chief of the Edisonian tribe, Deaf Thomas himself, like Deaf Beethoven himself, transformed the system of music. But Chief Thomas thought that the music should be the property of the people who recorded and distributed it. He was the source of the image of music as work for hire, which has hovered around the inherently hostile relations between recording companies and musical artists since that time. If the Edisonian tribe had wound up for sure in possession of the idea of the right in the music as belonging to the recording company or entity, it would have wound up like French literary copyright law, vesting its ownership rights not in the authors, but in the publishers. In the end, what evolved in the world of musical distribution was a complex hybrid of things promised and things forbidden and things cheated on of the most uncertain kind. But the essence came to depend upon dividing the right over the music into two rights, one based in the music as a literate phenomenon, music written down, and thus held by an author and a publisher of written music, and the other a mechanical right based in the activity of those who recorded the music as performed and distributed the recordings. But again, we needn't worry just yet about the precise forms of legal relationship if we understand that music is still, even in its alienated Edisonian form, it is still preeminently a thing passed around. And this brings us to the reason for the superiority of anarchist distribution. More than a lifetime ago, an American social psychologist named Stanley Milgram, who ultimately became famous for something else, began to functionally study the nature of what we now unproblematically call the social network, but which in Milgram's initial investigations was still like dark matter, an unstudied part of the nature of the world. Milgram created an experiment in which people, we shall come a little bit later to what he meant by people, people on the west coast of the United States were given an envelope addressed to a stranger on the east coast of the United States, and they were asked to send the envelope to someone whom they thought would either know the addressee or would know someone who knew the addressee. In other words, to hop the envelope from one human being to another until ultimately it reached the destination on the front. Milgram, having done this both east to west and west to east, using a relatively commodious sample of people, came to the conclusion that on the average it required 6 hops to go from one side of the continent to the other, that the depth of the social network was 6 degrees on the average of separation. This, because another artist in drama picked it up and used it as the form of conceit, as well as title of a drama, came to be a very famous result, much more famous, in fact, than the experiments with prisons and the administration of electric shocks, imaginary prisons and real electric shocks, that Stanley Milgram later came to be known for. But that result, that there are 6 degrees of separation on the average among Americans, oddly enough, of course, what Stanley Milgram meant by people was white people. And his output took into consideration, or rather failed to take into consideration, the presence of insulators in American society, like, you know, racial discrimination, such that it turned out that we were more separate than 6 degrees. That's ironic also in part because the play that was made of the conceit also concerned itself with the inability to see kinship, which, as my teacher and colleague Charles Black ultimately described, as the prima materia of tragedy and of the American tragedy in particular. But let us say, at any rate, whatever we may think of the particular metric involved, it's not the arithmetic that matters, it's the idea. Let us say that the principle that the social network contains a certain number of nodes between any two endpoints is really about the question of the economics of distribution. When music goes from the studio to post-production to physical manufacturing to delivery to a record store in the 20th century style, by the time it had crossed through 6 hands, it doesn't even get to the store yet. Under 21st century conditions, with music as a bitstream liberated from the physical manufacturing process of records or compact discs, of course, there are fewer steps. But even so, the fundamental problem for a music distribution system, as with any other system of distribution of zero marginal cost non-functional goods, is that it must compete, if it is to exist in a condition of competition, with the ability of everybody to give everything to everybody all the time, such that the total number of hops that anything must take in order to get from somebody who has it to somebody who wants it will be minimized by the network. There is no doubt that the BitTorrents of the world distribute music and movies and television shows and all the other forms of decorative bitstreams faster than even the optimized ownership-based distribution systems themselves. If Disney wishes to produce and distribute through its streaming service a new serial television program, unofficial distribution will be just as quick at getting it to everybody's hands as official, authorized, ownership-based distribution, because the network will frictionlessly carry anything, anywhere. What's happened since I wrote Anarchism Triumphant is that, at least so far as music was concerned, ownership had to emulate that form of immediate sharing to compete with it by producing what ultimately came to be propertyless services. It tries now to charge $30 extra for Mulan on its already subscription-based streaming service, Disney does. But I find it difficult to believe that anybody who didn't have the $30 to spend has had any difficulty getting a copy of Mulan. And as it turns out, there are, of course, far fewer people who want a copy of Mulan in, say, China than Disney thinks there are. Which means that its economic assumptions about what it can afford to produce by way of a thing it owns and distribute over a channel that it owns are probably incorrect, but the ability of everybody on Earth who wants to see the damn movie is unlimited. So what happened in the 21st century is that parties facing the superiority of anarchist production and distribution of zero marginal cost goods adapted to those realities. Most of the systems of distribution that have grown up in the presence of that deteriorative force for intellectual property have instead settled for subscription-based services. The endpoint receives by stream a copy of the music or the movie that immediately goes away. Technology is biased to make it more difficult to save the music or the movie as it arrives. Effort is expended at the creation of a merely technological form of competition reduction. Code doing the work of law, law having ceased to be efficient in its operation. While in the technology industries, everybody pretty much agreed that anarchist production of software, like anarchist production of mathematics and science since the 17th century, produced optimal goods, and they adjusted themselves to making their money not off the selling of software under shrink wrap, but on the services of fixing the software, maintaining the software, securing the software, running the software for you, computers located somewhere else with cheaper hydropower, or whatever. But the underlying change in political economy away from the advantages of ownership and towards the advantages of non-exclusion can be seen everywhere, as the desire of those who previously profited from exclusion from production and distribution instead tried to switch to systems that profited from engagement. This underlying change in political economy is why all the things that people keep asking me, why do they work, work. It becomes viable, then feasible, and now ultimately necessary for all the largest companies in the global IT industry to pay individuals salaries to make software the company does not own. Linux kernel developers are extremely highly sought after in the global IT economy. Individuals who will not go unemployed for more than 15 minutes. If they leave one company, they will be working in a quarter of an hour for another. And what do they produce for the company? Well, not the software. The kernel developers may or may not give a copyright to the people who employ them, but there is no ownership of the kernel as a whole and no leverage that comes by weight of a purely legal restriction. Instead, what companies get when they pay salaries to kernel developers is priority to the company's needs in the development of the kernel and trust in the community which makes the kernel, because the people that they choose to send to the kernel for their own purposes are valued and important to the kernel's developers as a community, and so everybody benefits. And nobody would be better off trying to reach for an ownership stake beyond their limits. There are other forms of free software in which the principle of non-exclusion even more thoroughly excludes ownership, and we'll look at those details next week in more closely. But what we see at the beginning of the process is that there are values created all over for which ownership is an inadequate proxy, and indeed for which ownership is an inhibition. This, the general principle of the role of anarchism in the evolution of digital products, is now so firmly ensconced that even great economists, Nobel Prize-winning economists, Nobel Prize-winning economists working at Columbia University can see and understand. I used to joke with my friend Yochai Benkler, now a professor of law at Harvard and an early exponent of this political economy. His work, The Wealth of Networks, is still the best overall exploration of this subject. I used to joke with Yochai that he would be the winner of the final Nobel Prize in economics, because once even the economists had figured out what he and I and a few other people knew, there would be no more need for Nobel Prizes in economics. Fortunately, that isn't quite correct, but I must say that I take great pride on behalf of the human race in the fact that the first woman to win a Nobel Prize in economics of her own scholarship, Eleanor Ostrom, was one of the earliest of the great economic thinkers in the world to perceive the essence of what it is that we do. Ellie Ostrom was a natural resource economist, and it was her work on the forms of resources that cannot be owned but that must be economically managed, like water resources and fisheries, that set the underlying economic rationale for what we later came along and proved to do, hence the cartoon. But I'm not really interested in being yet another cartoon character. I'm enough of that already. I want only to point out that what happened at the end of the 20th century, however much my tendency towards joking with 19th century political economy forms might have been taken for confusion on the subject, what happened at the end of the 20th century was a stage in economic history, one which put a number of thinkers and doers in the world at the awkward task of actually believing their own theory. It's nice, as you can see, at the beginning of the 21st century to be witnessing more and more confirmation of the accuracy of Einstein's general theory of relativity. He said, after the theory of general relativity was first published in that crucial moment of the First World War, he said, if the theory of general relativity is correct, the Germans will say I'm a German, and the French will say I'm a citizen of the world. And if the theory of general relativity is incorrect, the French will say that I'm a German, and the Germans will say that I'm a Jew. And of course, on that basis, I find myself happy to conclude that Einstein is now more and more a citizen of the world all the time, and nobody can say Jew about him anymore. But that's not the only way in which the process of believing one's own theory necessarily goes. At the opening of the 20th century, a great deal of capitalism depended on that post-war idea of anti-competitive, state-granted monopolies as the source of technological innovation. We proved, fully proved, that that was wrong in practice, vindicating the theory of people like Eleanor Ostrom, and forcing an awful lot of industrial capitalism's understanding of intellectual property to change. Anarchism triumphant and the death of copyright indeed. Capitalism too is an immensely fertile and creative substance, as everybody knows, those for it and those against it. And what it reinvented itself as, in large measure, we see now, is surveillance capitalism. And all depends upon the nuances of how computer software works, which in turn depends upon how computer software is made, which in turn depends upon the politics with which we view the law and the technology created by the discomforting and oddly revolutionary view of a few computer programmers who wanted to change the world. Talk to you soon.